Today is Thursday, June 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, voices from the protests that are shaking the United States.
As a black person in America, I feel like everyone should be very worried. And it's not just a black problem, it's an American problem.
Plus, retired U.S. military leaders speak out against President Donald Trump. And Australia's economy is in recession for the first time in three decades. Those stories and more are next. Our top story today. U.S. President Donald Trump and prominent members of his Republican Party have called for the deployment of military troops to put down nationwide protests sparked by the death of a black man in the custody of a white police officer. U.S. Defense Secretary Mark Esper said Wednesday that he does not support the use of active duty troops in quelling the unrest, which puts him at odds with President Trump. VOA White House correspondent Patsy Wadakuswara has the story.
Largely peaceful protests continued in major U.S. cities Wednesday, where tens of thousands defied curfews and the threat of the coronavirus to express outrage over racism and police violence. Earlier this week, U.S. President Donald Trump threatened to invoke a law which would allow him to authorize active duty forces to quell protests without governor's consent. Challenging the president's threat, Defense Secretary Mark Esper said active duty forces should only be used in the most urgent and dire of situations.
We are not in one of those situations now. I do not support invoking the Insurrection Act.
Wednesday morning, Esper ordered 200 active duty soldiers to return to their home base after 2 days of peaceful demonstrations in Washington, but abruptly overturned the decision just hours later after a meeting at the White House. Esper also distanced himself from a malign visit by Trump to a church near the White House to take a picture with a Bible. After police dispersed the crowd with flash grenades and chemical sprays, the move and his overall handling of protests have hurt Trump's approval rating. The unrest was triggered by the death of George Floyd, a black man who died after a white police officer pinned his knee on Floyd's neck for more than 8 minutes. All living American former presidents, including Jimmy Carter, George W. Bush, and Bill Clinton, have voiced condemnation. In a virtual town hall, former President Barack Obama urged mayors to review the use of force in their cities.
That was a far more representative cross-section of America, out on the streets, peacefully protesting, and who felt moved to do something because of the injustices that they had seen.
The protests have highlighted multiple systems of racial inequity in the country. The charges for Minnesota police officer Derek Chauvin have been elevated to second-degree murder, defined as intentional murder that lacks premeditation. Three officers who were on the scene have been charged with aiding and abetting the murder. Patsy Wadakuswara, VOA News, Washington.
Several prominent retired military officers have spoken out against President Donald Trump's actions and rhetoric during America's crisis, including retired Marine Corps General James Mattis, who resigned as Trump's defense secretary in 2018. The AP's Sagar Magani has more.
Mattis says he's angry and appalled after watching this week's events. In a statement published by The Atlantic, he says, "Donald Trump is the first president in my lifetime who does not try to unite the American people, does not even pretend to try. Instead, he tries to divide us." It's a stunning rebuke from the president's first Pentagon chief. Mattis has generally kept a low profile since resigning in December 2018. The president has falsely said he fired Mattis and did so again in a tweet last night, calling the retired Marine four-star, who is America's top Middle East commander, the world's most overrated general. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Among the other prominent retired U.S. military officials who have spoken out against Trump's actions is retired Marine Corps General John Allen, who once commanded the NATO and U.S. forces in Afghanistan. Allen wrote in Foreign Policy magazine, quote, "Right now, the last thing the country needs, and frankly the U.S. military needs, is the appearance of U.S. soldiers carrying out the president's intent by descending on American citizens," end quote. Allen, who is now president of the Brookings Institution in Washington, said the tear gassing of peaceful protesters outside the White House earlier this week by federal police to clear the way for Trump to visit the area was, quote, awful for the United States and its democracy, end quote. Retired U.S. Navy Admiral and former chairman of the U.S. military's Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mike Mullen, said he has been sickened by the crackdown on protesters outside the White House and opposed what he termed as, quote, an overly aggressive use of U.S. military active duty or National Guard, end quote. The current Air Force Chief of Staff, General David Goldfein, who is white, said there must be dialogue within the Air Force itself to address racism. Air Force Chief Master Sergeant Kalith O. Wright, who is the highest-ranking enlisted member and is black, said there is tension among Air Force personnel and that he himself lives in fear of American police.
My greatest fear is not for myself, is that I'll wake up one day and one of our airmen will be George Floyd or Tamir Rice or, you know, you Philando Castile, you name the person. So it's been tough, but I also realized that, one, it's okay for us to be angry. It's okay for me to be angry. But at some point, I then have to decide, okay, what next? And what should we be doing about it? What conversations should we be having? I realize this is a tough, race is a tough conversation for a lot of us, for a lot of our commanders out in the field.
For more on the military's reaction to and role in the unrest, I spoke to Stephen Pomper, who is Senior Director for Policy at the International Crisis Group. I first asked him why he thinks these retired military officers are speaking out.
I think they're thinking about the people in the armed forces who come from communities of color, who I think have an enormous amount at stake in this sort of moment of domestic reckoning with a system that has systematically discriminated against those communities. I think they're probably thinking about the Constitution, and people in the military are very much motivated by a sense of mission, the sense that they are out there defending a Constitution that has at its core the right of peaceful protest. And I think there's another piece of it too, Jason, which is that these are leaders who know what the U.S. military is good at and what it's not good at. And they know that, you know, the U.S. military is trained to deal with conflict situations, and that it's not necessarily the tool that you would use for a situation like dealing with peaceful protest or even managing rioters. Those aren't conflict situations. And I think there's a genuine worry of what kind of escalation you could see if you deployed that level of force into a situation where it's just not warranted.
There have been some prominent Republicans, the president, Trump, of course, himself, but also a prominent Republican senator, Tom Cotton, have loudly called for sending in troops to quell what are essentially peaceful protests. What do you think of these calls to use the military to crush these protests?
It's hard to think of anything that would be less wise or productive. There's a huge difference between a riot and a conflict. First of all, most of these protests are peaceful, and that there may be some riots on the margins, but the overwhelming bulk of what we've seen over the last week are peaceful protesters marching for a cause. And what's staggering to us as sort of a conflict prevention organization is the rhetoric that you're seeing coming out of some quarters in Washington that almost seems to yearn for the idea of characterizing the situation as an armed conflict. Why in the world the national leaders of the United States would want to characterize a domestic situation that is seemingly very manageable as a conflict, where you're describing some factions of the American people as the enemy, suggesting that the people who are out on the streets are combatants, which has the implication, you know, that they might be even targetable for the military. Why one would want to go in that direction is truly befuddling to anybody who's looked at the implications of that framework in the rest of the world.
But looking at the military and the different divisions within the military, within the other, you know, government armed groups in the U.S., whether they're police or border patrol or FBI or federal police, local police, these are a lot of armed groups, essentially. How does that add to the difficulty of the situation that the U.S. is facing right now?
Yeah, it's a mess. it's a real problem that it doesn't seem like the Pentagon is even aware of who was controlling a helicopter that was hovering over protesters a few nights ago, or that people who walk through downtown Washington find that their streets are obstructed by contingents of armed men who you can't even identify who they're with by the insignia that they're wearing, because they're not wearing any insignia. This crisis started in part because of the unaccountability of security forces with respect to the excessive use of force. And the idea that the right answer to the situation is to flood the streets with more unaccountable, unidentified security forces is troubling, to say the least.
That was Stephen Pomper, Senior Director for Policy with the International Crisis Group. While the politics play out, the protests continue. Many may wonder just who are the protesters. VOA's Ian Bior has been covering the demonstrations here in Washington, D.C., and spoke to a number of the folks who have taken to the streets, despite the threat of police violence. She filed this report.
While Washington, D.C. has seen two consecutive nights of relatively calm protests, the anger that sparked this nationwide movement is palpable.
His dream was to go to Vegas, to take his family to Vegas and live there. So he did just that as a man. And when he got to Vegas, guess what Vegas police did? Shoot him in his face, in his home, in front of his kids. He can't be just another hashtag, bro.
For this protester, who lost his brother due to police violence, and to others like Mohamed Ndoye, the demonstrations are necessary, and they're personal.
I get a handcuff on me one day.
When?
It was a couple years ago. I was driving my BMW. They stopped me, asking me, whose car is this? I was getting to the plane, and first class, they told me, you're in the wrong side. Okay? Why? Because my color.
Floyd died in police custody on May 25th. Some protesters, like Yaya C, say his death was the tipping point that forced them into the streets. But they also say they are protesting for other black people who have died by the hands of police.
It started this year with Ahmaud Arbery, a black young man, just jogging. I'm a track runner. That hit very close to home, because how am I supposed to go on jogs having to worry about my life? It makes no sense. As a black person in America, I feel like everyone should be very worried. And it's not just a black problem, it's an American problem.
Protester Marjan Nadari was part of a team that brought water, masks, refreshments, and solution for tear gas treatment to share with other protesters. She says it is important for her to do what she can to support fellow demonstrators.
As human beings, we have an innate sense to seek justice and bring justice to the ground. And because it's such a powerful feeling, we initially forget to care for ourselves as humans. And oftentimes we're not meeting our needs as humans. And so when we're able to step back and say, okay, in order to continuously protesting, we have to keep the momentum and give energy and give food and care for our people as one, regardless of where it comes from.
Crowds remained in front of the White House well after curfew both nights, as protesters actively worked to keep the peace. Yen Deng Bior, VOA News, Washington.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jason Patinkin. Hong Kong police Thursday arrested some demonstrators as they dispersed rallies marking the anniversary of China's Tiananmen Square crackdown. Thousands of Hong Kong protesters lit candles and chanted democracy slogans as they defied a ban against gathering to mark the deadly crackdown on pro-democracy demonstrators on June 4, 1989. Hong Kong's government bans the annual event this year because of concerns about spreading COVID-19. Hundreds of young protesters are thought to have died when China's military rolled through Tiananmen Square to halt weeks of demonstrations. China bans discussion of the protests on the mainland, but Hong Kong, a former British colony under Beijing's rule, still holds annual commemorative events. This year, protesters say the demonstration is particularly important in light of Beijing's move to impose new security legislation on Hong Kong. China's government says the legislation is needed to prevent subversion and terrorism, but many Hong Kong residents see it as an erosion of their rights. The number of COVID-19 cases globally has topped 6.5 million, with nearly 390,000 deaths. On Thursday, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson opened a virtual summit meeting of world leaders to build cooperation and funding for the effort to find a vaccine against the coronavirus. Governments around the world are starting to count the cost of fighting the pandemic. On Thursday, Canada's government reported exports dropped by nearly 30%, a record, largely because of the collapse of auto sales. In the U.S., the number of people applying for unemployment benefits topped 43 million. And the European Central Bank sharply increased its pandemic emergency support program by 600 billion euros to 1.35 trillion euros, or $1.5 billion, to keep credit flowing during the steep downturn caused by the virus outbreak. VOA's International Edition continues. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports that the coronavirus shutdown and the summer bushfires have ended Australia's run of 29 years of uninterrupted economic growth.
George H.W. Bush was the US president when Australia last went into recession in 1991. That proud record of almost 30 years of uninterrupted growth has come to a shuddering halt. In a recession, an economy shrinks or goes into reverse. Latest figures show the Australian economy was in trouble before the COVID-19 outbreak, after a devastating bushfire season, a slowdown in tourism and weak domestic demand. The pandemic has only added to the decline. Lockdown restrictions to stem the spread of the coronavirus saw thousands of businesses forced to close, from gyms to cafes and theatres to many shops. Unemployment is expected to double to 10%, and massive financial stimulus packages have sent national debt soaring. The government is warning that the outlook for the months ahead is dire. However, Australia appears in better shape than other G7 and other Asian countries, which have had much bigger falls in national income. Federal Treasurer Josh Frydenberg.
What we were facing was an economist's version of Armageddon. We have avoided the economic fate and the health fate of other nations because of the measures that we have taken as a nation. Now, the June quarter, the economic impact will be severe.
The Governor of the Reserve Bank, Philip Lowe, said Australia was facing the toughest conditions since the Great Depression. But he too said it was possible that the depth of the downturn will be less than earlier expected. These are anxious times for many Australians. As unemployment increases, many of those in work are feeling greater job insecurity and face higher levels of household debt. All this against a backdrop of fears of a potential second COVID-19 outbreak. Australia's recorded just over 7,200 confirmed coronavirus cases. The majority of patients have recovered, but 102 people have died. Various lockdown restrictions, including the reopening of schools, bars, cafes and beauty salons, are gradually being eased across the country. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
A new United Nations report accuses the Philippines government of waging an illegal campaign against suspected drug users, in which thousands are being killed and arbitrarily arrested with impunity. The report, released by the UN Human Rights Office Thursday, calls for justice for the victims and for perpetrators to be held accountable for their crimes. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
This hard-hitting report sets out in stark terms the devastating toll the government's war on drugs has taken on the Philippine people. It says the government's focus on countering security threats and illegal drugs has resulted in widespread and systematic killings of thousands of alleged drug suspects and human rights defenders over the past 5 years. According to official government figures, more than 8,600 people have been killed. But the UN Human Rights Office estimates the real number to be at least three times higher. Yet during this time, it notes only one policeman has been convicted of killing a drug suspect. The main author of the report, Ravina Shamdasani, says key policy documents relating to the campaign against illegal drugs lack legal protections. She says they also contain troubling language, such as negation and neutralization of drug suspects.
And while these terms are not specifically defined, when you couple the use of such ominous language, with the kind of high-level rhetoric calling for the killings of suspected of drug offenders, we find that this may amount to a permission to kill. This may be interpreted by police as a permission to kill.
The report finds police routinely make house arrests without warrants. It says there's evidence of police cover-up of killings of unarmed victims. It says most of the victims of the illegal drug campaign appear to be men from urban communities living in poverty. But Shamdasani tells VOA that data about how many people have been killed and who they are is very limited.
What their socioeconomic backgrounds were, you know, the gender, the where they lived, and even whether they were users of drugs or involved in the drug trade, for example. Now, our position is clear. People who use drugs or sell drugs do not lose their human rights. In fact, the UN advocates for the decriminalization of the possession of drugs.
The Human Rights Office says it shared the first draft of the report with the government last week. It says the government provided a number of substantive comments, many of which have been incorporated in the report. However, it adds there has been no official response since the report was released. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The G7 group of some of the world's largest economies said a debt relief initiative for the world's poorest countries could be extended beyond the end of the year to help deal with economic fallout from the coronavirus pandemic. The ministers of the world's most advanced economies also said creditors should fully disclose terms of public debt and limit use of confidentiality clauses, including for state-owned enterprises. For more, I spoke to journalist Nicolas Pinault in Paris.
So far, no, I haven't read anything officially from China, but back in the days when the French president put out this statement and this criticism against China, Chinese authorities, they just mentioned that, you know, for decades, especially during colonization, European countries took advantage heavily on African countries and on poor countries, and that's kind of criticism right now, that the fact that some loans made by China are really unfair for some African and some poor countries in general. That's a criticism that has no reason to exist, because according to them, they're offering a lot to Africa, especially building hospitals, official buildings, and roads. Basically, according to them, African countries, they have what they pay for their money. The U.S. Department of the Treasury put out a press release late last night mentioning this statement on behalf of the G7, and they're obviously talking about the debt relief, which is pretty important, and it's going to be able for some countries to waiver the crisis. We're talking about $20 billion of liquidity, which is something that these countries such as Angola, Jamaica, Ecuador, and Zambia are going to use, of course, to spend money on social relief for their people. But I think what's interesting also is the fact that the G7 is really calling on the importance of being transparent as a lender. And for some people, it's a direct hit to China, which, of course, is giving a lot of money through loans, especially in Africa, where it represents a third of the African debt, which it's a total is $365 billion for African country. And a third of this debt is owned by China. So the fact that the G7 is really addressing that situation, because that's been a pretty huge criticism against China regarding the fact that it's not really transparent and it's a heavy burden on some countries to reimburse that, that's something maybe that's show you maybe in the coming months that maybe some tensions with China regarding that issue. So all the seven countries members of this G7 agree on. You understand that the U.S., there's something that they're supporting, but you're right also, the French government is pushing strongly against some terms of the debt. They're targeting China, they're targeting also Russia, who is increasingly present in Africa. And according to them, the fact that they're lending so much money, sometimes through project by building roads or hospitals, but the fact that then the African countries, they have to reimburse so heavily and sometimes with some rates that are really difficult for some countries, especially in Africa, to reimburse. That's the major concern here for the French President Emmanuel Macron. But also, Japan agrees on this statement, Italy, the UK, Germany, and Canada.
That was journalist Nicolas Pinault in Paris. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Have a great evening.